like you first to turn, if you will, to Job chapter 22. Job chapter 22. I'm getting everything set up here. Maybe we can make all this work. There we go. Okay. Last week, we talked about the very first couple of verses of chapter 22. Eliphaz, one of Job's friends, is speaking. He has asked a question which is different from the other questions which are being asked. And that question was, in my translation anyway, can a person do anything to help God? Or, in another translation, can a human being contribute anything from God? And I think, Sydney, you read from the message, are any of us
strong enough to give God a hand or smart enough to give him a hand?
Yeah, and it's that first part, to give God a hand. I told you the week before that that it was very important that you knew the answer to that question. What's Eliphaz's answer to that question? Eliphaz had just asked the question of Job, but he has an answer. He knows what the answer is. What's his answer?
I think he considers it rhetorical.
Yeah. He considers it answering itself. Of course not. We spent last week trying to find what the Bible says about this. And what, those of you who were here last week, what was the conclusion? Can a man be of help to God?
Yes.
Yes. In what capacity? Okay,
when he says hardly, it's because you're a first-class moral failure.
Yeah, but you're still reading Eliphaz. Eliphaz's answer is no.
Right.
But the Bible's answer is not.
Oh,
no. We had to go to 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and 4 and 5. What was the conclusion?
Yes.
And what's our function?
Point the way.
It's in one word in the tail end of chapter 5. I told you to read chapter 3 and 4 in the hopes that you'd get so interested you'd read on into 5 and you'd see it. Okay? We walked through this very quickly. We said that God is a God who reveals himself to people, and we don't have a part of that. We can testify to what he's revealed, but we're not the ones doing the revealing. God is the God who redeems people. He redeems people, but that's not our doing. We can testify to being redeemed, but we're not the ones who do the redeeming. God is the God who reconciles people to himself, and that's what 2 Corinthians says we have a part in. And at the end of this, what it says is, it's as if we are ambassadors for Christ. It's as if God was calling you through us to be reconciled to him. We are ambassadors for Christ. We had the chance on our boat trip, when we were away from you for a couple of weeks, we were in Europe, occasionally on a boat, most of the time on a bus. High water and low bridges will slow the boats down, it turns out. Didn't know that going in. We know that now. But in any event, we were in a couple of capitals, in Vienna and in Budapest, and we saw embassies. And in embassies are ambassadors and the staffs of ambassadors. What do ambassadors do? They represent a government someplace else in the place they are. We are ambassadors for Christ. That's the role that we have. Most of you are coming in here from having attended the gathering. So you didn't get to hear the choir sing in the traditional service. The third verse of the anthem that they sang, here's what it said. What joy if those in need could see your light of love aglow in me. Then sing this song eternally, my Savior and my Lord. That's a pretty good way of summing up what we tried to talk about last week.
We sang Don't Worry, Be Happy. It's sort of the same thing.
That's sort of the same thing, I guess.
Same idea, right? Flow from the inside out, right?
Sure. Let's say that that's right.
It's a reach, but you can do it, though. Don't worry. Give it to the Lord.
Right. We just fill in the middle, right?
Right.
Okay. Now, it's our job today to try to keep going. So what we're going to try to do is go through the rest of what Eliphaz had to say. We've looked at verse 2, we've looked at verse 3. Verse 3 asks that same question a slightly different way. Is it any advantage to the Almighty if you're righteous? Would there be any gain to Him if you were perfect? What does he think the answer to that question is? He thinks the answer is no. That's a fascinating question. Would there be any gain to God if there was one human being who was perfect? That was supposed to be a softball.
There was one.
There was one. God's Son came, and He was, and it has made all the difference in the world. Eliphaz is saying things that he himself does not understand. He's going to do better later in this chapter. But up at the front, he's asking questions that he thinks are just self-obviously, no, 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 no. He's really asking fascinatingly interesting questions. Would there be any gain? Well, he's speaking specifically to Job, if you were perfect. But the implication is, if anybody was perfect, well, there was one perfect person. And through that one perfect person has come the salvation that we enjoy. Now, I want to take you now into a little bit more of what he's saying. Verse 4. Remember, Job is in crisis. He's lost his children. He's lost his possessions. He's lost his wealth. He's lost his health. And the first thing he said after those 7 days and seven nights of silence when his friends showed up, first thing he said was, I wish I'd never been born. But then he kept saying, I'm blameless. I'm blameless. And his friend said, you can't be. Look at all your suffering. Only wicked people suffer like this. And so that's where the divide has been. And in one form or another, that's been the way the discussion is going. And it may have seemed repetitious to you. I hope not. I'm hoping I'm bringing out with you the slightly different ways that they're looking at this. But Eliphaz is now coming into this. In verse 4, he says in this translation, this is New Living, is it because you're so pious that he accuses you and brings judgment against you, the judgment being all the things that you've suffered? And then verse 5, he says, no, it's not because you're so pious. It's because of your wickedness. And then he says the most amazing thing to Job. There is no limit to your sins. Isn't that a helpful thing for his friend to have said? Are you following me along? Is this matching up with what you've got?
Yeah, then you list all the things.
Okay, yeah. Start at verse 6, 7, 8, and 9. And I want you to see if you can see the words that repeat. I don't know if your translation does like mine, but I'm looking at New Living, and I see some words that repeat. I see the same words in each of those. What are those words? Can you see them?
You must have.
And what does he say? He says the most awful things. Verse 1, for example. And remember, there's no limit to your wickedness. There's no limit to your sins. And that's the reason God has brought this judgment on you. For example, you must have lent money to a friend and demanded clothing as security, leaving him stripped to the bone. You must have refused water for the thirsty and food for the hungry. You probably think the land belongs to the powerful and only the privileged have a right to it. You must have sent widows away empty-handed and crushed the hopes of orphans. And then verse 10 and 11, what's repeated?
This is why this has happened to you. Verse 11, this is why this has happened to you.
Eliphaz got it all figured out.
Bill, yours says may have.
Mine says must have.
Must have. Yeah, mine just says you did it.
Yes. Yeah, well, but the cool thing is, if you take the translation you must have, you see, I am making an assumption based on the miserable condition I have found you in. You are being punished by God, and the only way God would punish anybody that badly is if the sins are mounting up to heaven. So therefore, you must have. I think that's a good translation. When he says you did, that implies he has knowledge. When he says you must have, it's suggesting an assumption. And I think that's the closer to what's being said here. But that's why I like several translations in front of me at once. Are we okay so far? Now, let me pause for a minute. You must have refused water for the thirsty and food for the hungry. You must have sent widows away empty-handed, crushed the hopes of orphans. That's why. Did Jesus have anything to say about things like that?
Yes.
What did he say?
He said
the day's going to come that God's going to be on his throne separating sheep from goats. In the first hour, that came out as separating sheep from goats, and it didn't work at all. I warn you, if you try to say this to somebody else, watch out for that. Separate sheep. What was the separation? The separation wasn't doctrinal purity. It wasn't belief systems. What was it?
You fed me when I was hungry.
Did you take action? Did you notice when people were in trouble, and did you take action to try to do what you could to do that? So those people who work at Robius Hall in the food ministry, I have deep admiration for that. Those who work in English as a second language, those who go to the prison like Paul and I did. God said through his son, taking practical action, that's the test of whether you belong to me. And it's really interesting that Eliphaz is essentially repeating that. He's simply assuming that Job is guilty. And maybe Job was guilty at some point, but he and God have worked this out. And Job sees himself as, what's our word? Blameless. What was God's statement to Satan back in chapter 1, of which Job is completely ignorant? Have you noticed my servant Job? And what's the word God uses? Blameless. Right? There's three or four different ways. Pure, honest, blameless. But blameless is the word I'm picking up because I think that's the one that fits the best. If I say that he is never sinned, I don't think that's what Job even would have said. He would have simply said, I am innocent, meaning I've got no sin that God and I haven't dealt with. And we talked quite a bit about this kind of things we went through. So far, okay? So Eliphaz is actually saying some right things, but he's made the assumption that Job has done these terrible things and has not ever repented or turned around from that. Starting at verse 12, Eliphaz moves in a totally different direction. And I want you to notice the direction he moves in. God is so great, higher than the heavens, higher than the furthest stars. And then you say, he's saying to Job, that's why God can't see what I'm doing. How can he judge me through all that thick darkness? For thick clouds swirl about him and he can't see us. If I can't see him, then he can't see me. Have you seen the signs on the back of the big trucks? If you can't see my mirrors, I can't see you. Be careful. But he's accusing Job of saying, I can't see God, therefore God can't see me. He's stumbling a little bit at that point, but that's what he's talking about. But it's a switch from what he said before. Verse 15, will you continue on the old paths where evil people have walked? Verse 17, for they said to God, leave us alone. What can the Almighty do to us? And yet he was the one who filled their homes with good things. So I'll have nothing to do with that kind of thinking. Then he comes down, I'm skipping a little bit, come down to verse 21. Starting at verse 21, I want you to watch what Eliphaz is saying. Submit to God and you will have
peace.
Things will go well for you. Listen to his instructions, store them in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. So clean up your life. If you give up your lust for money and throw your precious gold into the river, the Almighty himself will be your treasure. He will be your precious silver. Then you will take delight in the Almighty and look up to God. You will pray to him and he will hear you. And you will fulfill your vows to him. You will succeed in whatever you choose to do. And light will shine on the road ahead of you. Verse 29, I've got a really kind of cool thing in the electronic device that I have up here. I've got the ability to put New Living Translation in one column, put the message in another column, and I have the ability to highlight with color various things that are here. Okay, I've got verse 29 highlighted in a different color from every other highlight I can see nearby. And that's because in about 2 months, okay, maybe 4 weeks, but my bet's more on 2 months, when we finish Job, one of the last things we do, we need to remember verse 29. I'm just giving you that little look ahead. Way at the end of the book of Job, you're going to find verse 29 coming back. And if you can remember verse 29 when we get there, that'll help. So just sort of put a star on that. If people are in trouble and you say, help them, who's he going to say that to? Look at the verse. Who's he going to say that to?
God.
He's going to say that to God. Then God will save them. Listen again. If people are in trouble and you say to God, help them, God will save them. Who's saying this? Eliphaz. The irony that you're going to find in verse 29 is going to knock your socks off. You got to get all the way to the end of Job and recognize what you're seeing to see it. But verse 29, Eliphaz is a prophet and his prophecy is coming true. Job is going to do exactly what he says. And who's he going to do it for? He's going to do it for Eliphaz. That's what's coming. So make a note of verse 29. Verse 30, even sinners will be rescued. And they'll be rescued because your hands are pure. Well, what's the problem? Problem is this, is what Eliphaz has said between verse 21 and the end of the chapter, is it wrong? Take a leap of faith, guys.
Well, the part about submitting to God and prosperity will come your way, it may not be earthly prosperity,
yeah,
but it is something we're all called to do.
That's the only part that I have trouble with. Beyond that, other than that first little bit, the rest of it is about the best advice anybody could ever give. It's great advice. The problem is, Job's already there. And Eliphaz can't see it. Listen carefully. The advice Eliphaz is giving, other than maybe just that first phrase and the implications of that first phrase, the earthly prosperity that comes, other than that, he is giving just about the best advice you'll find. In fact, hundreds if not thousands of years later, we don't know exactly how far back Job goes, when the prophet Isaiah comes along, he gives you almost exactly the same advice. And I want to match those two up because it's really, really important. Prophet Isaiah says almost the same thing that Eliphaz says here. What's the only problem with Eliphaz's comments? He's assuming Job needs to go to the first of this. The problem is Job is an outlier. There is a sort of a norm that happens. And that's... Let me pause for a minute. I'm doing this a little out of order, but in the first hour it didn't really work very well this way. I want to tell you right now what your assignment is going to be. Today we're going to get through what Eliphaz is saying, and that's as far as we're going to get. Because we're going to go to Isaiah, we're going to look at what Isaiah says, we're going to line that up against this, and that's going to take up all the time we've got. So what's your assignment for next time going to be? You're going to read the rest of Job with the starting at Job 23. Okay? Would you please look for just a moment at Job chapter 25. Just for a second at Job chapter 25. And my question is, who speaks? And how long does he speak?
Not long.
And who starts speaking almost immediately in chapter 26? Job starts speaking again. So other than maybe four verses or six verses out of Bildad, and remember when we get to the end, Zophar doesn't speak at all. Then starting at chapter 23, it's pretty much, this is Job's last run. And that goes, I think, all the way to chapter 33 or something like that. I want you to really take a good hard look at that. When Job finishes speaking, his friends are silent, Job isn't speaking. Okay, now who speaks?
Nope.
There are four or five chapters, and somebody comes in out of nowhere and begins to speak. And I want you, we're gonna call him either Elihu or Elihu. And I've decided, since I'm teaching, we're gonna call him Elihu for the purposes of this course. After that, you, or outside the room, you can call me anything you like. Yeah, because that's what it comes to. You come, Elihu? That's what people say when they play the Giants. Elihu? in any event, what I want you to recognize is you've got pretty much five chapters, maybe six, where Job speaks. A little intervention about six verses from Bildad in chapter 25, is it? I think that's right. And then, but otherwise, it's Job for several chapters. And I want us next week to start on that part. But realize, when Job finishes talking, he's silent, his friends are silent, and suddenly this guy Elihu begins to speak. And only after he's finished does God speak. And here's what I want to ask you to do. I want you to pretend you don't know God's going to speak. Because I think you have to read this in the context of the people who are speaking. Job doesn't know God's coming. Elihu doesn't know God's coming. Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, they don't know God is coming. But God's coming. And so I want you for a moment to suspend your knowledge of that and look at what Elihu says in the context of what's been said before. So that's your assignment. Get started on that process. So let's go back now, because what we're trying to do is take a look at Eliphaz's. This is going to be the last thing that he's recorded as saying. And these last 10 or 12 verses, whatever it is, from 21 through 30, maybe 10 verses, it's actually very good advice. And what I want to do is take you to Isaiah chapter 30, chapter 58. And I want us to walk through the parallel. So if you'll do that for me, we'll be in good shape. Isaiah 58. It's going to take us a little while to get to where the parallel starts, but I want you to see the context. Chapter 58 of Isaiah starts out with someone saying, "Shout for all your worth, do not hold back, raise your voice like a trumpet." Can you tell who's speaking by reading verse 2? God is speaking. To whom must he then be speaking? To Isaiah the prophet. So now let's start again, knowing this is God speaking to Isaiah. "Shout for all your worth. Don't hold back. Raise your voice like a trumpet. To my people, proclaim their rebellious acts. To the house of Jacob, their sins." And now he starts commenting to Isaiah on the command he's just given him. "They seek for me day after day. They long to know my ways. Like a nation that has acted uprightly and not forsaken the law of God, they ask me for laws that are upright, and they long to be near God. Quote, why have we fasted if you don't see? Why mortify ourselves if you never notice?" End of quote. And then God begins to speak to the people through Isaiah. "Look, you seek your own pleasure on fast days. You exploit all your workmen. The only purpose of your fasting is to quarrel and squabble and strike viciously with your fist. Fasting like yours today will never make your voice heard on high." Now, I want to pause for a minute. I didn't do this in the first hour, and I should have. What were the acts of worship that every good and faithful Jewish person was supposed to do?
Pray, fast.
They were supposed to pray. Jesus said, when you pray, go in your closet, shut the door, because there's people who pray out in the public, and they're getting all the acclaim they want. You go and you shut your door, right? Remember that, when you pray? Right? There were three things he said. One was when you pray. What was the second?
When you fast.
When you fast. I'm going to leave that for last, so let's go pick a different second one. Second one was when you give. When you give alms. I don't think it was in this place. It was a place like this where he said, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Lots of people give in such a way that they want the world to acclaim them for their giving. He's the one who looked at the widow and said, she's given more than all these others because she's given everything she's got. And she did it in such a quiet, intimate way. Nobody else would have noticed but Jesus. Remember that? Okay. And then he said, when you fast, don't look like, oh, I'm just in such... Act like everything's normal when you look. You remember those three things? Collectively, what are those three things?
Sacrifice.
Worship. Collectively, that's worship. So what I'd like you to do just for a moment is replace the word fasting with worship, and I think you're going to get closer to what Isaiah's doing. Again, I forgot to do this correctly in the first hour. I think this is more correct here. So, verse 3, start of the verse. The people are asking, why are we worshiping if you don't see? Why are we doing worship that mortifies us if you do not notice? And then God speaks to Isaiah, to the people through Isaiah. Look, you seek your own pleasure on your worship days, but you're exploiting your workmen. Your only purpose of worship is to quarrel and squabble and strike viciously with your fist. Worship like yours today will never make your voice heard on high. Is that ringing a little bit clearer when you say it that way? It's not a perfect fit, but it's as close as I can get it. So now I want to start at verse 5. Is that the sort of worship, remember I'm doing the replacement, that pleases me? A day when a person inflicts pain on himself, or hangs his head like a reed, or spreads out sackcloth and ashes. Is that what you call worship? A day acceptable to the Lord? Verse 6, no. This is the kind of worship that pleases me. What's the first thing he says? Four words in my translation. What's the first thing he says? Say it again.
To loose the chains of injustice.
I think that's a better translation. Mine says to break unjust fetters. To loose the chains of injustice. To undo the thongs of the yoke. Did you have a chance to go to worship today? Did you hear him talk about yoke just a little bit? To let the oppressed go free and to break all yokes. Isn't the best of worship sharing your food with the hungry and sheltering the homeless poor? And if you see someone lacking clothes, to give him clothes, but not turn away from your own kin in the process of doing it.
Ephesians 4:8 says, work hard so that you may have something to give him who has need.
Now, I want you to notice the first word in verse 8. And I'm hoping it's the same as what I have. It's the word then. Does yours have that? Okay, now let's put this together. Let's put this together. You only see the word if back in the middle of verse 7, at least in my translation. But it's implied all the way through. If you do this, if you do this, if you do this, if you do this, verse 8, then this is what comes. Right? What did Eliphaz say? Back in that section we were looking at. Do you remember? He says, if you do this, if you do this, if you do this, if you do this, verse 26, then all these things will happen. That's the parallel that I'm trying to show you. And the sort of the pivot of that parallel is verse 8 here and verse 26 back in Job 22. So now let's look. Verse 8. Then your light will blaze out like the dawn, and your wound will be quickly healed over. Saving justice for you will go ahead, and the Lord's glory will come behind. Verse 9. The word then again. Then you will cry for help, and the Lord will answer. You will call, and he will say, I am here. Middle of verse 9 goes back to the if statements. If you do away with the yoke, the clenched fist, and malicious words, if you deprive yourself for the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, middle of verse 10, there is an implied then. Can you see it? Then your light will rise in the darkness, and your darkest hour will be like noon. And it goes on in this vein. Do you see that? Okay. In the first hour, I started to try to say what these then statements are talking about. And as I did so, a sweet person sitting in the empty seat where Emmett would be if Emmett could be here today, a sweet person sitting in that started reading them off. And I said, you already know where I'm going. She said, yeah, I've got notes in here. Did you teach this before? And here's my answer. Yes, I've taught this at least 5 times. And I'm going to keep on teaching. And most of you get this down. And then I can say, okay, I can move on to something else. We've done this before. Now, here it goes. Here's the first one. Your light will break forth like the dawn, and your healing will quickly appear. I'm focusing on that word appear. Your light will break forth like dawn. Your healing will quickly appear. People will notice, and your influence will extend. That's the key. The first thing God says is, if you begin to act as I'm encouraging you to act, your influence, can I say it, our influence will begin to rise. People will begin to pay attention. Why are they paying attention? Because we're doing things that most people don't do. We're doing them in ways that most people don't do, and we're doing them for reasons that most people don't see. Our influence is the first thing. Here's the next one. Righteousness, your righteousness will go before you. And I want to emphasize the pronoun. So let me say it again. Your righteousness will go before you, and the glory of the Lord will be your rear guard. I'm away from it, but I think I'm still in verse 8. I think I'm in the second half of verse 8, but I've got some notes here where I've disconnected the verse numbers. Okay? That's your testimony. The first one, I think, talks about your influence. The second one talks about your testimony. When you start to talk, the first thing people hear is who you are. And then they hear your words. And then behind them, they realize, oh my goodness, I'm seeing God through who you are and what you say. The third one, this is the easy one. You'll cry for help, this is verse 9, and the Lord will answer. You'll call and He will say, I am there. What's that one talking about? So far, our influence, our testimony. What's this one? Come on, guys, it's not that hard. Deeper than that, speaks to prayer. Our prayer life comes alive. Our prayer life comes alive. Going on down, verse 10, this middle of verse 10, your light will rise in the darkness and your darkest hour will be like noon. That's our sense of direction. My goodness, what do I do now? God's going to give us a sense of direction. He's going to give our influence power. He's going to give our testimony a good hearing. Our prayer life begins to work. Our sense of direction begins to work. In fact, if you keep going into the first line of verse 11, I think that's the first break is at the wrong spot. Your light will rise in darkness. Your darkest hour will be like noon. The Lord will always guide you. I think all of that speaks to sense of direction. He will satisfy your needs in a scorched land. He will give strength to your bones. I like the NIV at this point. I think it is, you will be like a well-watered garden, like a spring whose waters never fail. That one's a little harder to see, but I think this is what it's saying. It's speaking of confidence. We have resources that are not going to run out. And that speaks to confidence. Our confidence will be stronger. Coming down to verse 12, the ancient ruins will be rebuilt, and you're going to be the key to rebuilding them. You're going to build those on age-old foundations, and you're going to get a new name. You're going to be called repairer of broken walls, restorer of streets with people who live in them. What does that speak to? Our ability to accomplish things. Our ability to accomplish things. And finally, if you come down to verse 13 and 14, it goes back to the if statements again. Do you see them? If you do this, if you do this, if you do this. Verse 14 starts with the word then, and my translation does it for you. Then you will find true happiness. One translation says you will find your joy in the Lord. Our relationship with God will be strong. Okay. Is Eliphaz's advice to Job good? It's terrific. Isaiah confirms it. And the things that God promises are powerful. And all of those have come to Job. If you read this six chapter section that I talked about Job, he's going to spend a whole chapter talking about what life used to be like. Read that chapter, and what you'll see is God has been fulfilling all of these promises, and then suddenly Job is taken. He's an outlier. He's taken to a place that very few people are taken. And this week, from a friend of mine, I got the word for that. This guy was writing to me about a question that's running through the university faculty right now. Are we going to do this? Are we going to do that? And he wrote me and he says, I haven't been able to be at the meetings where this is discussed. Can you tell me what you think? And then he explained to me in just a couple of words why he hadn't been able to make those meetings. He had had, listen to this, it's beautiful, a confluence of calamities. Isn't that a great phrase? A confluence of calamities. Confluence means where two rivers come together. Okay. He had an afternoon teaching schedule. All of the work that he had to be inflexible. He had to be doing that work at that time. His teaching schedule was an afternoon teaching schedule. His wife broke her leg and his children need to be chauffeured to all the things kids need to go through after school. And he says, I have had such a, and he used the words confluence of calamities. And I said, I'm going to use that as soon as I can. Because that's, Job has experienced it worse than he is, but that's what's happened. That the promises God makes, that's what almost always happens. But not always. Way back in the first of the Bible, Adam and Eve had two sons, Cain and Abel. What do we know about Abel? He was the one who was following God. What happened to him? He got murdered by his brother. Bad things happen to good people. And it starts off in one of the first three or four chapters of the Bible that we start to see that. So far, okay? Job has experienced all this, but he's been taken somewhere else. So what's wrong with Eliphaz is not his advice. His advice is terrific. The problem is Job's already done all that, every bit of it. And yet, still something else now is going on. Job is trying to dig deeper, and Eliphaz can't see where Job is. Now, does that help you make sense out of what's happening in chapter 22 is good, except Eliphaz is insensitive to where Job is. So far, okay? What's your assignment? Rest of Job, focused on? Chapter 23 and beyond, and chapter 23 is going to start you on Job's final run, interrupted very briefly by four or five verses from Bildad in chapter 25, and that's going to take you to maybe 33, and around 33 or 34, what happens? Elihu comes out of nowhere and starts to speak, and he speaks for a while, and then something happens, but I forget what it is, and I'm not going to let myself remember. We okay? We okay?
Yeah.
Let's have a word of prayer as we go. Our Father, Eliphaz's advice is terrific. It's just that Job has already done those things. But I know I haven't done all those things, and neither have probably most of my friends in this room. Because the if statements that we see here are pretty high standards. But that's what you're calling us towards, and what you are promising is to touch our lives with that. If we do these things, then your promise is that our influence, our testimony, our prayer life, our relationship with you, our sense of direction, all these things begin to strengthen in the ways that you want your children to be strengthened. And so we claim those promises for ourselves, recognizing as we do so that we have to be humble. We cannot demand them. We can only ask you to be able to fulfill your promises in us if we are faithful to you. But we realize that sometimes there is a confluence of calamities that comes on good people, and then something deeper is going on. So we're still seeking that as well. We pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.